I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
You are listening to Preconceived, where we examine the preconceptions that shape how we view the world and the paradigms by which we live our lives.
Hey everybody, I'm Zale Mednick, and welcome to another episode of Preconceived. If you are enjoying these podcasts, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify. It really helps with the podcast and for others to discover it as well, and makes me really happy whenever I see a new rating or positive review. Pedophilia, understandably, is a word that conjures up negative thoughts, feelings, and emotions. Acting on pedophilic thoughts is a horrible crime, and the ramifications are fittingly severe. But what exactly is pedophilia? Is it a distinct entity, a medical condition, or can it be seen as an abnormal part of the spectrum of human desire? What is it like to live as a pedophile, and what kind of emotional angst do pedophiles experience? Are pedophilic feelings more common than we might think they are? And ultimately, how can one live with thoughts of pedophilia without acting on them? I'm joined today by Sky Stevens. Dr. Stevens is an associate professor in the Department of Psychology at St. Mary's University in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and a clinical forensic psychologist in Nova Scotia. She completed her PhD in clinical psychology at Ryerson University. She's an associate editor for the Archives of Sexual Behavior and is an editorial board member for Sexual Abuse and Sexual Offending Theory, Research, and Prevention. She conducts research on the conceptualization, assessment, and management of atypical sexual interests in forensic and clinical populations, with a particular focus on sexual interest in children. A significant emphasis in her research has been on the development and evaluation of childhood sexual abuse perpetration prevention programs, as well as barriers to the implementation of prevention programming. As part of her research, she and her colleagues have recently launched an exciting prevention program called Talking for Change. All right, Dr. Sky Stevens, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So this is a sensitive topic, obviously, because there is so much stigma around it. And in many regards, there should be stigma around pedophilia, but it's something that's so misunderstood, probably, in some regards, I imagine. And that's what Preconceived is all about, kind of trying to tackle some of those topics that we think we have an understanding of, but there's obviously multiple layers of depth to it. Mm-hmm. To start off, what exactly is pedophilia? How would you define it? Because people probably don't have an idea of it that may or may not be totally accurate.
Yeah, it's a great question and definitely something important to kind of clarify at the outset, like what it is that we're talking about. So when we use the term pedophilia, we are referring to a sexual interest in prepubescent children. The term hebephilia often gets used as well, and hebephilia refers to sexual interest in pubescent children. So really kind of the key concept here is people having a sexual interest, an enduring sexual interest in children who are in kind of a period of prepubescence or pubescence. So they have like no secondary sex characteristic development, or they're just kind of starting to develop secondary sex characteristics. The really important thing to know, and I think in terms of thinking about this and kind of guiding even our conversation, is that there is a difference between pedophilia and child sexual abuse. Child sexual abuse refers to illegal sexual behavior with children, between adults and children, often is kind of the way it's discussed. And so those two things are not the same. They're not synonymous. So what we know in the clinical world and the literature is that there are cases of child sexual abuse that are, of course, motivated by sexual interest in children. Roughly, estimates are around like 50 to 60% of people who abuse children are driven by that sexual interest. But that means that 40 to 50% of people who abuse children are doing so for other reasons and don't necessarily have like this underlying sexual interest. And we're also aware of individuals with sexual interest in children in the community who don't offend and don't commit child sexual abuse. So I think that teasing apart of those two concepts is really key.
That's really important. So one is you can experience pedophilia but not act on it, which we'll talk about, and then which differentiates from sexual abuse. And then even amongst sexual abuse, you're saying there's 40% of people who would abuse children but they wouldn't be pedophiles. I guess some people might be questioning, so in that situation, why would somebody, and maybe this is a naive question, but why would somebody abuse why would somebody abuse anyone is the obvious answer, but why would somebody abuse a child sexually if they're not sexually interested in children? Like, what's that 40% composed of?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's something I think that is really difficult for us to understand. When we talk about sexual abuse, sexual offending more generally, whether it be against adults or children, this is something that can't be solely explained by like one single factor. So there are other risk factors that are important to consider. So in cases of like offending against children that aren't driven necessarily by pedophilia, you might see cases of people with high degrees of sexual preoccupation, sexual compulsivity, who are kind of seeking novel sexual experiences. They're engaged, they're very impulsive, more opportunistic. We also know that a subset of these offenses are perpetrated by people who are relatively antisocial. So substance abuse, like all sorts of other factors, can kind of mix together to cause this type of offending. And no single factor is sufficient. So even in cases of individuals who abuse children who have pedophilic interest, there's always like other risk factors that we're kind of looking at and trying to assess like whether they're present and related to the offending behavior.
You spoke earlier about the age and how it's kind of pubescent or prepubescent. Is there, it sounds weird because I mean, imagine at some point it does get gray, but is there an age at which, so somebody who, for example, is a teenager who, let's say, is 16 and they're quite in the midst of puberty and they've progressed, I don't want to say normally because there's no normal, but average, we'll say. And if an adult were to be sexually attracted to them, does that qualify as pedophilia or not really because they're already fairly advanced in puberty?
Yeah, so there's just different kind of gradients of this. So when we talk about, so I guess a couple of points, like with puberty and kind of the age range, when we talk about sexual interest in children, really thinking about kids who are in Tanner stages 1 through 3, and this is a way of kind of assessing secondary sex characteristic development. The age that kind of gets thrown around might be like 13, 14. So interest in anyone under that age would be kind of suggestive of like pedophilic or hebephilic interest. However, we know that age is like an imperfect proxy of sexual development. So you could have like a 12 or 13 year old who's already like gone through puberty, right? And so it's really more about the secondary sex characteristic development that's key. In relation to your question about like, so a 16 year old and kind of interest in that age range, we would say that that's not an example of sexual interest in children, because the person has, if we're thinking like typical 16-year-old, they've likely gone through puberty, they're kind of more in a post-pubertal stage, they're not fully necessarily developed. And so it's definitely, it's socially taboo, and it's, the age of consent in Canada is 16, unless there's like a power differential, then it bumps up to 18. So engaging in sexual behavior with like 16, 17, 18-year-olds is, yeah, you could get into trouble with the law. So there's all sorts of pieces around that. But it's, yeah, we wouldn't use the term like pedophilia or hebephilia. In fact, like if someone has a sexual preference for older teens, the terminology that often gets used is a phebophilia. So there's all sorts of different terms that are kind of used to describe sexual attractions to people across the lifespan. And the species typical interest is for individuals who are kind of fully developed, but kind of in that young adult age range. So, or kind of that young adult stage, at least when we talk about males, and that's referred to as teleophilia. So there's a lot of, yeah, different terms that are kind of used to describe this.
I think that's an important distinction. And I think that intuitively makes sense. And obviously there's ethical and legal ramifications, regardless if you are sexually interested and act on that on somebody who's in their later teen years, but that is different than pedophilia as you describe it. People probably don't understand why would somebody be attracted sexually or have a sexual interest in somebody who is, let's say, 12, 13 years old, for example. Mm-hmm. You've encountered many people who experience pedophilia. And again, to clarify, which you did really well at the beginning, this is not necessarily people who act on this. This is people who experience these feelings. Why would somebody be attracted to somebody who is in that age range? Is there a medical phenomenon to it? Is there a scientific explanation? Is it something that we understand?
Yeah, I mean, really, the debate on kind of etiology, like it's not set in stone. And so this is an area of ongoing research and debate. What we recognize, and I think what has been looked at in the literature, is this is a complex interplay of various factors. So there is a biological basis to this. There's been genetic studies, no like single gene causes this. And there's been different findings in that area. There's research on like brain structures, abnormalities, and like what's referred to as white matter in the brain. And the idea here is that the part of the brain or the systems within the brain that are important for like the recognition of sexual stimuli, like there's some decreased white matter in those areas. Now there's a huge debate in the area about like whether that's driven by like the actual interest, or a lot of these studies have been done with people who have a history of sexual abuse perpetration. And so whether those findings are due to the underlying interest or the behavior is kind of up for some debate. But there's clearly, I think, a biological basis to this. People don't choose to have these interests. I mean, why would you choose to have like one of the most ostracized kind of conditions that someone could have? And so that's important. We know in thinking through this, it's never just, you know, biological basis and that's the end of the story. There's like a complex interplay of psychological, environmental factors that are important. So for example, and the way that I sometimes think about it and have read about is that you could have like this kind of biological, underlying biological vulnerability to develop something like this, to develop a sexual interest in children, and that vulnerability is kind of brought out in certain environmental circumstances. So perhaps for someone, like there's some research on what's known as like the abused abuser hypothesis. So that the experience of childhood sexual abuse might be an important factor for people who actually have this underlying vulnerability. Again, not suggesting that people who are abused as children go on to develop this or to abuse children.
But it could be a risk factor or an association with it, that if you were abused as a child, that could be one thing that might tip you into that direction potentially.
Yeah, and we talk about, like, and this is a little bit, I've kept up with this literature, but kind of the etiology is a little bit, it's complicated, but we talk about like epigenetics. I don't know if you've like ever come across.
I have, but why don't you explain that to the listeners? Yeah.
Yeah. So people could have like a biological vulnerability to something, and that kind of vulnerability is brought into play or turned on, for lack of a better way to describe this, by certain environmental circumstances, or it lays dormant if those environmental circumstances don't, I guess, manifest. And so in this case, like if someone, for example, has a biological vulnerability to developing this sexual interest, and they experience certain things within their environment that might actually activate the expression of those genes, that would be important in the process of this development, versus you could still have a biological vulnerability, but because the environmental circumstances are in a way that is just the genetic vulnerability or the underlying vulnerability is not
activated.
Activated.
So it's this idea kind of with epigenetics that you might have, and again, you said there is no specific gene that's been outlined, but maybe there are multifactorial genes that are associated with it, that somebody might have those genes, but they're not really triggered to be activated to lead to those pedophilic feelings. Whereas in somebody else, they might have that same gene, but given their circumstances or whatever social factors are at play in their life, that gene that was primed becomes activated in a sense.
Yeah, that's like a perfect description of it. And so absolutely, there is a genetic or I just think of it more as like a biological basis to this, just like there is for you know, virtually all conditions, right? And when we talk about different sorts of things.
So my understanding is from the biological factors, the main ones that have been identified is this decrease in white matter, though you said it's unclear whether maybe those feelings of pedophilia lead to that decreased white matter or whether the white matter changes are what caused the pedophilia. And then in addition, there might be some genetic components. It's unclear, but it does seem like there are some biological markers that are out there in addition to some of these other psychological factors and conditions.
Yeah, absolutely. And they've done some studies on like different structural areas of the brain, like the frontal lobe and the temporal lobe. And there's like different findings and some conflicting findings in that area. They've done different testing with individuals to see like if they have like certain deficits, I guess, in different areas of cognition, like impulsivity, what we refer to like executive functioning, which is a whole host of skills around like, inhibition plays into that, but the ability of individuals to kind of, it's like higher order thinking, like making decisions, planning, those sorts of things, memory, intellectual functioning. So there's studies as well in that area. Again, there's some discrepant findings, but yeah, absolutely. I think that it's fair to say that there is a biological basis, and the way that this all kind of comes together to explain sexual interest in children is still being kind of, I think, solidified and researched.
So there are obviously other psychological factors at play, and you even just spoke there about impulsivity. Are there some people you experience who are experiencing pedophilic thoughts where they don't really have any other obvious comorbidities, where you'd kind of psychologically otherwise, I mean, normal again is not a good word. None of us is really psychologically normal, but
yeah,
where you'd encounter somebody who really otherwise is functioning pretty well psychologically and mentally in life, and they don't experience that impulsivity. They don't necessarily have anxiety disorders or depression, but psychologically they are mentally well, so to speak. Again, not the right terminology, but you know what I mean. Do you experience people like that where really the only thing that mentally they're dealing with is this pedophilia?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there are, and we know this from doing like research studies and kind of There's been a shift in the research on this. It used to be that we studied pedophilia almost exclusively in individuals who had sexually offended against children. And this has actually really shifted over the past 10 years, where we're increasingly able to conduct research studies with individuals who live in the community with a sexual interest, many of whom have not offended or who are not involved in the criminal justice system. And from kind of doing research on that group, it's quite obvious that there are individuals who have this interest but have managed to integrate it into their life in a way that is not causing them distress or impairment, is not leading to illegal sexual behavior, and there isn't another kind of like mental health condition, for example. Now, I, as a psychologist, often am working with people who come in because they're distressed or they're experiencing impairment, or I do a lot of forensic work as well. So people who've offended and are involved in the criminal justice system. And so in the group that I often see, and that's often kind of the focus in intervention, we do actually see a high level of what we refer to in psychology as like comorbidity, where the individual is experiencing this interest in addition to, like, there's maybe other mental health conditions present, a big one being like mood disorders. There's a high incidence of comorbid, like things like depression, very high rates of suicidality in this population as well. And so we do see some comorbidity, especially in our samples of people who come in to seek, you know, mental health services to help them cope with this. We don't often see or hear who have managed to integrate this into their life and are living offense-free lives, who, you know, aren't distressed by this or impaired, because they just, you know, they don't seek out mental health treatment because they're coping with it in a way that's not bringing them into conflict with the law. And yeah, they've managed to integrate it.
Those who aren't necessarily presenting with that kind of distress, or those who at least have not acted on it, is there any kind of idea? Because I think most people coming into this podcast probably didn't make that distinction of, they probably thought pedophilia means somebody who has acted on it, as opposed to just
Absolutely.
That feeling. Do we have any idea of the prevalence of people who do experience some of these feelings, but who don't act on them, or maybe who do come to you, who are in distress and get to you before they've acted on them? Do we have any idea how common that is? And I imagine it might be more common than most people think, because most people are just thinking of the people who are kind of sex offenders.
Yeah, it's a great question. We don't have a good, accurate, like, rate of, so like, what percentage of people who are in the community with pedophilia, not involved in our criminal justice system, have a history of like offending, whether or not that's been detected by the police. And when I think of sexual offending against children, that can occur online or offline. So when we talk about offline, this is kind of the typical type of offending that I think people often think about, but we also have individuals who are seeking out. The legal term in Canada is child pornography, but that term is not used in the literature because it doesn't, like, it's not pornography, it's child sexual abuse material. And so we use the term child sexual abuse material, or CSAM. Anyway, so in terms of the studies of populations of individuals in the community, I've seen it's such a huge rate. So like, when we ask people, like, do you have a history of offending, rates from like 10% saying yes to up to 75% in some of these like programs that are explicitly focused on trying to prevent offending behavior. And there's many reasons, I think, for the variation in that. Some of it is like how we ask the question. So if you ask people about whether they've sexually offended against a child, you might just ask about like, that's led to like legal involvement, right? And we know that by and large, most sexual offending against children is never brought to the attention of law enforcement, which is a whole other thing to think about and to consider, because that's a problem. And so if you're just asking about like detected offending, you're missing a big, potentially a big piece of the picture. And
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So once you start to ask about maybe undetected, then you kind of start to bump up. The higher rates that I have seen have been the studies that ask about undetected and are focused on, like, so for example, the 75% that I'm thinking of is a study from, I believe, a project where they've actually encouraged people who are distressed and having trouble managing their sexual interests but haven't come to the attention of law enforcement to come in and seek treatment. So it does make sense that there would be a higher incidence of sexual offending. And by and large, the majority of that is individuals viewing CSEM.
Yeah.
So it's complicated. We don't have a good, like, this is the number.
And that makes sense that this would be extremely tough to research because this isn't something, an emotion that people would endorse often, or it's even possible in a survey that they wouldn't necessarily admit to just out of shame and out of fear.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby. Mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa. Take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Ch-ch-chumba. ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
What exactly do people who experience these feelings feel? What is the emotion that they're feeling? Is it akin to the same way an adult has sexual attraction to another adult? Is the urge very strong? How can people understand what's going through the mind and even body physiologically of somebody who would be considered a pedophile?
Yeah, so I think this is really important. And there's no, like, single way, I think, of experiencing or, like, single pathway that people follow. I mean, people, when we talk, like, we talk about kind of the onset of these feelings. And what people often describe is that, you know, as they maybe go through puberty and start to develop their sexual interests, or that kind of system becomes activated. You know, maybe a 12 or a 13-year-old has an attraction to a 10-year-old. And that's not, you know, atypical, right? Because they're both kids. But what happens and what people describe is that as they kind of age and go through their adolescence, they become older, but their age of attraction does not age with them. And so they kind of go through this process of developing these sexual feelings, sexual interests, and then they're now 18 and they're still interested in 10 year olds. And so I think people often describe how isolating that is. I mean, there's not really a forum or a place for people to say, like, hey, mom and dad, I'm having these feelings towards younger kids, I need help. And then even if there is some acknowledgement of that, like, where do you go to seek help for that? I mean, this is such a topic that evokes such strong emotions. And I appreciate why it evokes strong emotions. I mean, we're talking here about really complicated things. And when we start to think about child sexual abuse, of course, that evokes a really strong emotional response from people. But that strong emotional response can make it very difficult for people to disclose their interest, to find appropriate supports. People are scared, they're isolated. Maybe through isolation, they might develop like other comorbid mental health issues like depression. They might experience a level of hopelessness. So I think it's from talking with people who've had this experience, it's a period in adolescence. So we're also talking about kids at this period, right? These are individuals, teenagers who are coping and trying to cope with something that is really difficult to kind of come to terms with. And they're doing it on their own. And that is, as a mental health provider, that also is, you know, it's not okay.
And that's probably, that's obviously super, super challenging, especially when you're in those younger ages and maybe you're 13 and you're thinking, okay, it's normal. Maybe I'm attracted to a 10-year-old. We're both kind of kids still. And then at what point do you kind of have that insight and say, wait a second, now I'm 16 and I'm still attracted to a 10-year-old. That's a bit weird. And I could imagine it's a slippery slope, so to speak, where you end up being in your 20s and you're like, well, this is just how I've always been. And it's so gradual that you don't even know until finally you're like, wow, this is definitely strange.
Yeah. And you're going, like, if you think about adolescence and that kind of early adulthood period, like there's so many other things that are happening in that period. And we know, I think that this is actually a really key part or time for intervention and support, because we don't want people like dealing and coping with those kinds of feelings on their own if they're distressed. Like, we want to give them an outlet to explore and do that in a way with like a mental health professional, for example, and make very clearly this important distinction between interest and behavior. You can have this interest. You do not have to act on that. There are ways to help you manage that, because we want to prevent victimization from occurring in the first place, right? And it's not just about preventing victimization. I mean, that's an important piece, but it's also helping people who are struggling to develop coping skills that will allow them to achieve like pro-social goals and live a meaningful offense-free life. And I think as a society, we need to figure out a way to provide support and services to individuals as early as we possibly can. And we cannot do that easily in this social climate.
One of the things I've spoken about before in a few of the psychological based episodes I've had, and I've spoken about how I've had anxiety before and OCD, and I did an episode on that. And this is obviously very different. But the reason I bring it up is because one of the lessons I've learned that's helped me through therapy is you can't always control your emotions and you can't always change how you feel. Sometimes you just need to accept how you feel. That's the reality, but you can act in a certain way. Yeah. So I wonder if that applies in a lot of the ways that you are treating people who come to you or helping with prevention. How do you address people when they come to you? Because I'm guessing it's similar that it's tough to say, don't feel like that, because you can't control always how you feel. Yes, action might be able to then change the way you feel to an extent, but is there a level of accept this is how you feel, but we're going to move forward and we're going to manage it via X, Y, Z?
Yeah, so it's a great question. So what we're starting to see in this space is more of these programs for individuals prior in an optimal situation, prior to any sort of like illegal sexual behavior. We have a program, myself and my colleagues here in Canada, called Talking for Change. It's a free program. We have a national helpline. The helpline is open to anyone who is concerned about their own personal risk of offending, either online or offline, or who's struggling with sexual thoughts or urges towards children. But also, I think key is that it's open to other people who might have concerns about a loved one or something that they're observing in their environment and they want support. So there's a helpline, but then a key part of our program is also therapy intervention. And so this program is for individuals who want to seek formal therapeutic support. And so it's similar in many ways to other kind of mental health programs. Like, we would go through, for example, coping, like, what do you do when you're coping with like strong emotions, right? Or having trouble with behavioral like with inhibition or impulsivity? How do you cope when you're dealing with really strong sexual urges that are inconsistent with your values and are going to bring you into conflict with the law? And so there are strategies that we can teach people. But I think to your point, this is something that, and I think this is another important piece, is we can't change someone's underlying sexual interest, right? And so this is have to cope with for their lives. And so part of the process in terms of therapy is helping people understand that, come to terms with that, accept that, and know that there is a very clear distinction between having that underlying interest and having like engaging in sexually abusive behavior. You can have that interest and you do not need to act on it. We all, and like you had mentioned OCD, right? Like there are lots and lots of thoughts that people have, urges, right? If you look even at some of the studies, like they do look at things that people might have urges to do, like you're standing on a subway platform, sometimes people might have an urge to push somebody else. It's just an urge. You don't have to act on it. And so there is a space in between your feelings and your thoughts and behavior. And our clients absolutely have to understand that, because they cannot act on those feelings and those thoughts without causing immense harm to a child. And so they need to kind of come to terms with that. And then it's about helping people develop strategies so that they don't, that they're able to manage that and don't necessarily, don't lead, it doesn't lead to sexually abusive behavior. And also importantly, to build strengths, resilience, help people build the lives that they want to live in a way. And again, like if you can build up people's strengths and resilience, help them build a life that's worth living, that is going to be incompatible with offending behavior. So we do that currently. There's various programs like this throughout the world. Probably the best well-known program and one of the first programs in this area was in Germany through Project Dunkelfeld. And there's been many programs that have been kind of popping up in this space.
So once a client has hopefully come to terms with this condition and understanding that they can't necessarily stop the thoughts, what's the approach that is often recommended by therapists? Is it to accept the thoughts, so to speak, and entertain them, and even as controversial as this might sound, allow their minds to fantasize where their minds will go? Or is it more, let's try and shut this down, because we know that it is very tough to just change the way you think. It's more realistic in many situations to accept the way you think and change the way you act. So how do you advise people to think and to control their thoughts, to engage in them or not to engage in them? And I imagine that is probably a controversial question.
The person is going to have these. And I think the other thing just to mention is that oftentimes people will have this sexual interest in addition to having like sexual interest in fully mature adults. Mm-hmm. So there can be kind of like an exclusive or non-exclusive profile. And so people who are non-exclusive, which are by like the majority of individuals to our knowledge who have this interest, have some level of interest towards fully mature adults. And then there is a subset who obviously are more exclusively oriented who don't have any interest in engaging with adults. So yeah, like how do people cope with that, especially our clients who are more exclusively oriented? So I think in terms of like, like you can have a thought, a fantasy, you can notice it. My concern would be in engaging with that, you know, how does that affect the individual? For some people, like whether if it's like just kind of through fantasy, then that could, you know, that might not increase like their preoccupation around the thoughts, or maybe it does. So we actually don't really have a good sense to be able to make like a broad-based recommendation about how people should necessarily engage with those thoughts, and that has any sort of discussion of this has to be done like with immense consideration of like the individual factors for that individual. Because it might be for one person, it leads to like greater sexual preoccupation. You could see like some people might make an argument that, okay, if you're fantasizing, maybe you're spending more time fantasizing. And then like it could kind of go into a direction of maybe viewing material, which is obviously illegal and harmful. And so versus someone who might be able to say, okay, yep, I have this thought, I'm going to think about it, but then I'm able to kind of move from there and it's not going to lead to illegal sexual behavior. So we really don't know like who falls in what group. And so really the strategies are, I think, around acknowledging and then figuring out other ways to cope and to manage. So one example might be, there's this concept we talk about around urge surfing, where people, and this can be applied to when we think about sexual arousal, but it can also be applied to other like intrusive thoughts or like emotional distress, where often people will, like, let's say people experience a distressing sexual thought. It might kind of build up to a point where it becomes very intense, but then it dissipates. And so we have to help people or kind of help people realize that, okay, this isn't going to last forever. It might build, you don't need to act on it, but it will dissipate over time. Maybe you need to engage in behaviors at that point where you like distract yourself, go outdoors, do something else. There's all sorts of other kinds of strategies that I think we can use to help people in those periods where they're struggling. But even with those other strategies, you still have to accept that you're having that thought. It's actually probably even more problematic for people to repress, because that causes problems. People, when they try and repress something, it's not an effective strategy. It actually can make it worse.
Yeah. And again, that's similar to OCD, where I'm not trying to make this about myself, but a lot of what you're saying is relatable, not in terms of those pedophilic thoughts, but in terms of just thoughts. The more in OCD you try to repress a thought because you don't want to think about it in obsession, the more it comes back even stronger. It's just so sad. It's needless to say, extremely sad for anybody who is the victim of somebody who acts on these pedophilic thoughts. That's needless to say, but should be said. But it's also extremely sad just hearing about the emotional distress that somebody who doesn't act on these feelings must be experiencing when they can't control what they feel and they're trying to control these urges, and they are, but it's also so taboo to even talk about that it's tough to even get help. It sounds really, really awful.
Yeah, I think, and that's what we often hear from, and I think part of it, right, is if you have depression or anxiety, or you're struggling with like some sort of something that's happened to you, like trauma, or you're going through a period of grief, I think in our society, we've seen this shift over time where people are more open or more willing, not everyone, of course, but to share those feelings and seek support. And that's, I think, a really positive development, because people shouldn't have to struggle on their own and through isolation. There is help available. I recognize that, of course, there are issues with access to services, regardless of what the issue is that you're seeking treatment for. But for some issues like this, it's not just a matter, I think, like there's, like, who do you disclose this to? I mean, even it, you run a risk in doing that because of, you know, is this going to be someone who is going to listen, be supportive, maybe help me find treatment supports? Or is this someone who is going to become very upset, maybe share this more widely, and then people have, you know, I think valid concerns about their safety? In a perfect world, I think we would be in a situation where individuals with these feelings could disclose them in a way to their supports and be able to seek help if they need that help, because it doesn't keep anyone safe. If your concern is around like prevention, right? It doesn't keep anyone safe. It doesn't prevent violence from occurring when we push something to like the fringes of society and make it such a like you can't even talk about it, right? I mean, how does that help? It just isolates people. It gives people a sense of hopelessness. People could develop, you know, well, this is just the way I am. Like, what's the point? Maybe then it could push people into communities like online, for example, where there's discussions around like normalization, discussions around like offending behavior. And we don't want that. In fact, I think we want to allow people to seek help if they need it and to be able to disclose this if appropriate.
Absolutely. And you hit the nail on the head there. I mean, talking about anxiety and depression is a lot, still taboo, but a lot less taboo than it used to be. But this is a whole different kettle of fish. I mean, I can imagine somebody would have a tough time telling their best friend they're experiencing these feelings out of fear that best friend is naturally going to say, well, I don't know if I feel comfortable having you around my child, or worrying that even if they don't say that, they're thinking about it. And that's why programs like yours, like Talking for Change, are so important, so people can have a place to talk about it early on and to get the supports they need. Scott, you've done a really, really great job of outlining what pedophilia is, what it isn't, distinguishing it from sex offenders, obviously the overlap that you described. Do you have any final thoughts that you want to share with people about this topic where you think there might be a preconception or anything for that matter?
Yeah, just to reiterate that difference between interest and behavior, and they're not the same thing. And just to acknowledge as well, obviously, that child sexual abuse online, in all of its forms is wrong. It's illegal. It's harmful. We know the repercussions of that. And in my world and kind of my field, we talk about prevention of abuse towards. And I think we often focus on strategies targeting maybe like children, right? So like, what sorts of things do they need to know, or should they, you know, about like behavior from adults or other kids that might put them in a situation where like there's a situation that leads to like sexually abusive behavior. But it's not the responsibility of children to prevent their own abuse. Really, I think those approaches, while important, education is important, really the responsibility is on individuals not to abuse. And so we need to more carefully think about what sorts of things we can do from a prevention standpoint that target people who may be struggling, and even like more generally, right? Like, what do we need to do at a societal level to start to change the way we talk about sexual abuse? We often, and like, this is totally going a bit off topic, but like in organizations, you know, there's this assumption that, okay, we're going to give everyone a criminal record check and we've done our due diligence around sexual abuse prevention. That is not sufficient. 95% of cases of child sexual abuse are perpetrated by people who have absolutely no history of that. And so we need to think about what sorts of educational prevention campaigns can we embed into different organizations that are providing services to children and youth around like primary prevention support. So it's a little, yeah, I guess sort of off topic, but related to the prevention piece.
No, it's very related, and I feel the need to say, just because this topic is so stigmatized, that we haven't focused so much on condemning, obviously, that any sexual violence against children is by no means okay, but I think it's important still to have these kinds of episodes, because it is important to talk about pedophilia and understand it better, because the more you try and suppress it and just synonymize it, so to speak, with sexual misconduct, then it becomes more stigmatized. It pushes people who experience these feelings down and they have nowhere to talk about it, and it probably just increases the number of people who are engaging in bad sexual activities. So obviously the most important thing is that is never condoned, but it's important to understand it and talk about it, because that's the first step in preventing these kinds of things from escalating to a point where there is violence that's being committed.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sky, where can people learn more about you, and where can people learn more about Talking for Change, the program you referenced before?
Yeah, so people who are interested in learning about Talking for Change can visit our website at www.talkingforchange.ca. We also have the website is in French, and like there's helpline support. It's not just offered in English. We offer it in several languages. So there's a helpline that operates from 12 to 6 Eastern Standard Time. So I would direct people to our website. There's different organizations as well who work in this space, like Stop It Now, for example, also operates a helpline. There's online, like for people who might be struggling with their thoughts, but not ready to kind of reach out for assistance. There's various like online programs. So there's something called Troubled Desire, which is an online program with like different modules that people can kind of go through at their own pace to receive some of the information that they would receive in a treatment program, for example, but obviously not under the guidance of a therapist. For teenagers who are dealing with this, there's a program, a resource called Help Wanted. So there's lots of spaces. And I would say for I guess anyone who is struggling with whether it be thoughts around this, I mean, I've given you some resources there, but just if anyone's struggling with kind of like distress related to these thoughts, or also people who are experiencing this and have either survived childhood sexual abuse or are being abused, like help is available. You can disclose this. There's formal therapy support. Even if you're a child, you're experiencing this. There's resources like Kids Help Phone Line. And so just to encourage anyone who is troubled by these issues, who's experienced these issues, whether regardless of how they've experienced it, and that there is help available and they should not be ashamed or scared to reach out for help. It's you don't have to go through the experiences of childhood sexual abuse or the experiences of dealing with confusing thoughts and feelings on your own.
Very well said. Dr. Sky Stevens, thank you so much for joining me on this really important topic that I think it's important that we help destigmatize by talking about. So thank you so much for joining me on Preconceived.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
And thank you, everybody, for listening to another episode of Preconceived. Have a great day.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.